Well, thanks so much, Justin. It's a huge honor for me to be here today. And I want to say thanks to Biola and to Bridgeway for the opportunity to present and share with you this morning. I want to start by telling you my story. When I was 6 years old, I decided to become a follower of Jesus. I grew up in a Christian home. I went to church every week. I even went to a Christian school most of my life. But you know, I had a lot of questions about the Christian faith growing up. And some of these things really began to bother me. Kind of like that famous Homer Simpson line where Homer says, "What if we choose the wrong religion? We're just making God madder and madder every Sunday, right?" Well, I went to a place called Biola University for my undergrad, and in my New Testament class, they were talking about things like the resurrection of Jesus, like it was true, right? Like there was no such thing as religious truth over here and regular everyday truth on the other side. And I decided that if truth is just truth, if there's no such thing as religious truth and regular everyday truth, if Jesus really rose from the dead in time and space, if Christianity is really true, and these facts are no less true than the fact that I'm standing here right now, then this has to affect my entire life. Jesus says that we know these things. We can know these things to be true. We can know them. How many college students we have in here today? All right. College students, you know, one of the great truths of being a college student is that you always seem to need money for some reason. And I was in that particular situation. So one day, I got myself a little job assisting a handful of professors at Talbot School of Theology and the Philosophy of Religion department. One of these professors was a man named J.P. Moreland. And whole new worlds were opening up to me as I would stand there at the photocopy machine copying hundreds of handouts for his philosophy classes. And this eventually led me into the world of Christian apologetics, and eventually I got my master's degree in Christian apologetics from Biola University. Incidentally, the same program that you can find out about here today. And so this is how I got into this, and for the past 10 years, I've been training students to be better prepared ambassadors of Jesus Christ. Last year, I had the opportunity to do 15 workshops right here at Bridgeway, and what came out of those classes are a series of lessons that I had the opportunity to write called Accessible Apologetics. What I wanted to do with these lessons is to take ideas that have to do with defending the faith and make them simple to get and easy to remember. And so I incorporated a whole bunch of fun games and weird acronyms, stories, objects, illustrations, things like this into the curriculum. These are the things that tend to stick. And I've found that in a variety of churches now, lots of people who have gone through this series feel more comfortable with everyday apologetics. I want to ask you a question as we get ready to dive into our material here today. How many of you have ever been in kind of an everyday situation where you are sharing your faith with that skeptical friend, that skeptical family member, and then after the conversation, you walk away thinking, did I say the right thing? Maybe I should have said it another way. Oh no, I should have said this. Anybody ever been there? Yes. Amen. I've been there too, and I'm still there sometimes now. Well, a lot of times I'll walk away. I don't know if you're about you, but sometimes I'll walk away thinking, what did they think about what I said? Did they get it? Will they even remember it? And that's what I want to talk about today, how to share good reasons to believe in a way that's simple to get and easy to remember. I want us to see how we can use these in our everyday conversations, whether you're talking to your skeptical friend or even answering questions from your own kid. Like me, the Christian kid, growing up at home. Lots of questions about the faith. So here's what we're going to do today during our time together. First, I want to share with you what I like to call the three essential elements of everyday apologetics. Three things that you should really do with the information that you're learning here this weekend. And then we're going to spend most of our time talking about using stories, objects, and illustrations to explain spiritual things. And you're going to see exactly how you can use some of these things in some of the common issues that come up, that people bring up at your family or in your work, at your kid's soccer game, or even in the church. Because I find that a lot of Christians are asking the same kinds of questions as our skeptical friends. So let's begin with the three essential elements of everyday apologetics. Three things you should really do as a defender of the faith. The first thing I think you should do is to find answers for yourself. You see, apologetics is for you. It's for you. It helps you first and foremost as a disciple of Jesus to know that there are good answers to the hard questions so that you don't have to stay awake, lie awake in bed at night wondering, do I really have to let go of my reason so I can have faith? Or do I have to do the opposite of that? Do I have to chuck the faith so that I can be reasonable, so I can hold on to my reason, my better judgment, so I can believe things that actually make some sense? We don't have to worry about things like that. We don't have to stay awake at night worrying. There are good answers to the hard questions. And so apologetics is for you. It helps you understand the answers to tough questions about Christianity. But of course, apologetics isn't just for us to get answers. It's for others too. I bet you've never ever seen a fire put out by a bunch of firefighters who did nothing else but sit around reading a bunch of manuals on how to put out fire. And so yes, we do need to give illustrations and examples and share reasons to believe with others. Like Peter said in 1 Peter 3:15, we need to be prepared always to give an answer, a reason to anybody who asks us about the hope that we have in Jesus. But we do it with gentleness and respect. And so the second thing we need to do is to share answers with others. We need to give good reasons to people who are asking the tough questions about Christianity. And you guys get this. That's the amazing thing. Look at how many people are here today. You guys understand this. What you are doing here, everybody who is investing their time here this weekend at a conference like this, you are doing something that matters here today. People are walking around with all kinds of questions about the most important things in life, and somebody needs to give them an answer. You know, part of approaching people, I think, is being wise. We need to be wise in the way that we engage in conversation. And that's the third thing that I think we should do, is to be wise ambassadors of Jesus. We need to be wise ambassadors of Jesus. You know, I was recently in Canada speaking at a conference with Craig Hazen and also a Christian apologist by the name of Greg Kokel. And Greg Kokel likes to say that apologetics can look more like diplomacy than combat. Apologetics can look more like diplomacy than combat. I like that. I really like that. I think we need to hear people out. You know, if we want people to listen to our story, to listen to our ideas, we need to listen to their stories, to their ideas. And so before we get ready to just be giving people answers, I really want to encourage us to really find out where our friends are coming from. Ask them questions honestly, openly, and care. Because if you ask them questions, it shows that you respect them. It shows that you want to understand where they're coming from. And so find out exactly what your friend believes. This is such a no-pressure approach that it really gets a good conversation going. So even just asking a question like, what do you mean by that? Somebody makes a statement. Say somebody says something kind of off the cuff, like it's stupid to believe in God. All right. You could just ask, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Because if you think that it is stupid to believe that there's this giant Santa Claus type figure with a big white beard sitting on a cloud somewhere granting wishes all day long, then yeah, I think that's kind of silly too. But just asking, what do you mean by that? Or even better, you could say, how did you come to that conclusion? Or what's your thinking on that? I'm really curious, why do you think that? And then just listen. We need to make sure we listen to people. If you ask these questions right, if you ask it and you really care, which is really kind of the point, you can't be thinking about what you want to say next, and you really care, it might actually help your friend think about what they believe and why they believe it. And that can be a valuable thing just right there. And you know, if you're stumped by a question, no problem to say, that is a great question. It really is. And now I'm curious. And so let me look into that and get back to you. Afterwards, do your homework and look it up. As you've already seen here this weekend, there are good answers to the hard questions. And you're going to see more of this as Dr. J.P. Moreland comes up here to present later on today. But part of being wise, I think, is getting our point across in a way that people can understand. I've been thinking about this. How can we make our answers simple to get? How can we make our answers easy to remember? Part of being wise is to make sure that we make our answers memorable. We need to make our answers memorable. During my graduate studies, I quickly learned that apologetics can include all kinds of different disciplines. Christian apologists can use arguments, evidence, theory from different disciplines like science, like history, philosophy, and even communication. I taught a number of communication courses over the years, and I'll share with you something kind of sad, actually, that communication researchers have discovered. That no matter how good Craig Hazen was, no matter how interesting J.P. Moreland is going to be, you're probably going to forget half of everything you hear this weekend. Why? That's because we typically forget 50% of everything that's said to us right after somebody finishes talking to us. That's half of it gone, just like that. But it gets worse. Because 8 hours later, that 50% goes down to just 20%. No joke. And so researchers have been very curious, what is that 20%? What makes up that 20%? It's the examples. It's stories, illustrations, memorable quotes, objects, or concrete things you can see in your head. These are the things that tend to stick. Think of them like business cards that you might hand out. I still have a business card in here. My apologetics guy, business card. That was fortunate. When you hand these things out, if somebody comes across your card, chances are they'll probably remember you. When your friend remembers the illustration that you use, chances are they're probably going to remember your point. And so I want to talk about using stories and illustrations today. It's not just enough for us to have good answers for ourselves. We got to share that information with others. And I think we need to make those answers memorable. Stories, objects, and illustrations are a great way to do that. You know, I remember when I was in third grade, it was the mid-80s, Halloween time. It was the first time my parents let me go out, dress up, and go around trick-or-treating and get candy from just some people in the neighborhood. And this was huge to me. Huge. Why? Because my parents had heard all these crazy stories about psychos taking razor blades and shoving them into apples, messing with kids' candy, right? And their friends heard these stories too, and so they were kind of hesitant to let me go out and do this. And, you know, they wanted to check my candy stash before I began eating the candy right when I got home. And I remember even hospitals were volunteering to x-ray candy for people. But you know, I recently discovered there's a big problem with this popular story. It's totally fake. It's totally fake. In fact, in 1985, there were two sociologists who looked into this, Joel Best and Gerald Horiuchi. They decided to study every reported Halloween incident since 1958. And do you want to know how many instances they found of razor blades being shoved into apples or strangers messing with kids' candy? Zero. Not a one. The whole thing was a total lie. But it just, everybody believed this. My parents heard it. My parents' friends, the stories went around. Think of all those urban legends, those myths, those crazy videos on YouTube with all kinds of misinformation in it that seemed to go viral overnight. Why does it seem like it's so hard for us to remember things that are actually true? You know, it reminds me of that quote by Mark Twain, who says that it seems like a lie can get halfway across the world before the truth can even get its boots on. So why does it seem like it's harder for us to remember information that's actually true? Well, I think some of this has to do with the examples that we use. Stories that tend to stick often include something unexpected, like a razor blade shoved in an apple. Something concrete that you can see in your head, like a razor blade shoved in an apple. And when you think about giving that to a kid, well, that becomes something emotional too then, doesn't it? A razor blade shoved in an apple. But I think we can actually use some of these kinds of things when explaining our faith, things that are unexpected, things that are concrete, things that are emotional. These are just three examples of the things that tend to stick. Let me show you what I mean just by briefly talking about five common issues that people tend to bring up, that I've seen brought up as I've done student ministry and missionary work over the past 10 years. Let me just talk about, in your handout it says four. I'm going to try to do five for you, give you a little bonus, okay? Number one, the idea of faith. Isn't faith just a blind leap in the dark, right? We've been talking about that this weekend. Number two, the difference that God makes. What difference would it even make if God's even real? What difference would it make in everyday life? You know, Sam Harris says, if we just lost all the knowledge in the world, when would we have to recoup that knowledge that God exists in order to get along in the world? When would we have to do that? Does it even make a difference? Number three, the evidence for God. Are there good reasons to believe that God is even real? Number four, the problem of evil. If God's good, why is there suffering in the world? And then number five, the need for Jesus. Why do I need Jesus to go to heaven? I'm basically a good person. But now, a little caveat, what I want you to know is that it's not my intention here today to give a full treatment to any of these issues. No, what I want us to do is to take a look at these issues briefly and just see how we can use stories and illustrations and examples to make our answers simple to get and easy to remember. So let's begin with the concept of faith. And for this, I'm going to turn to the world of video games. How many of you are video game people in here? Awesome. I actually contemplated bringing my son's Xbox controller this morning, But I knew that he wouldn't be happy about it because he was still asleep and he would be like, somebody came in the house and stole my controller. Of course, there are two of them, but he would still care. So I turned to the world of video games. Our family isn't a big gaming family, but a few years ago, we got an Xbox 360 and we began to play games together as a family. And we played a game called Lego Indiana Jones. And in Lego Indiana Jones, there is a part where Indiana Jones has to cross this invisible bridge. Actually, there's about two or three invisible bridges in this Lego Indiana Jones game. And it seems kind of crazy because you just have to do it. You have to act like you're going to kill your character by having Indiana Jones just walk off a cliff. But really, you're walking on air. That's how it works. But it seems kind of crazy. Now, in the movie, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, if you've seen the classic film, you know that this is kind of messing with his head. Does he follow the instructions in his father's diary and step out into what looks like nothing against his better judgment? It feels like to him, he's giving up his better judgment, his intellect, his reason, and just taking this leap of faith. Now, a lot of people in the church, a lot of people and even Christians feel like faith is kind of the opposite of reason. You know, if you have all this evidence, how can you have any faith? Right? The name of this conference is Reasonable Faith in an Uncertain World. And that does sound kind of odd to people, right? Like, I thought faith had nothing to do with reasoning. I thought it was all just about this blind leaping into some sort of religious experience. Well, biblical faith isn't blind faith. That's not the historic Christian definition. As you heard this morning, Craig Hazen talked about 1 Corinthians 15, right? The strangest passage in all of religious literature. Why? Because the Apostle Paul hangs the validity of the whole Christian faith by a thread. You know, the thread that's made out of, you know, this alloy that can never be cut, the adamantium, right? Just kidding. Nobody knows about that. All right. When I was in chemistry, I was like, sir, where's adamantium on the chart? Adamantium. You know, it's the world's strongest metal. Wolverine skeletons made out of adamantium. But the Apostle Paul pins the validity of our entire faith, our entire religion, on a historical event which is either true or false. According to Paul, if Jesus did not rise from the dead in time and space physically, the whole faith is fake. Nobody should follow Jesus. We should do something else. On top of that, the real God's still going to get us for our sins, and now we're lying about God because we went around telling people that Jesus really rose from the dead. And so this is very unique. This is very interesting to see that biblical faith is not blind faith that's opposed to reason or evidence or logic. Biblical faith is an active trust that's dependent on a historical event that can be investigated. And you can find the Christian definition of faith in Hebrews 11:1. And it says this, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction or the evidence of things not seen." So faith isn't wishing, it's assurance. And what is that assurance based on? Evidence. How does that work? Well, let me give you an illustration that contrasts these two definitions. Imagine you really, really wanted a new iPad, but you just couldn't find one anywhere. Now, if you just wished with all your might that a brand new iPad would be delivered to your house and would be sitting there when you got home, and you were convincing yourself of this, and you went to Best Buy on the way home and you picked up a nice case and a keyboard and fully expecting to be using your iPad that night, well, that would be kind of like this blind leaping, right? Or say you entered a contest to win a new iPad online, and you hope you'd win, but you have no assurance there, right? Blind faith, this just wishful thinking, is like blowing out your birthday candles. It's like chucking a coin into a fountain, right? You got nothing. Now imagine this. What if you went online and actually bought yourself a new iPad because you found one that was available, and you got a little email that said, thank you for your purchase. Later on, you got an email that said, there's a package scheduled to be delivered to your house. Let's say you got a FedEx tracking number for it. The next day, you wake up all excited because this is the day that it's supposed to be here. You get that tracking number. You go to work. You track this thing all day long until it says, delivered to doorstep. Yes. And then maybe your spouse is home. You get a little text. Your iPad is here. Now when you're driving home, if you want to stop by Best Buy and pick up a mouse or something, you have a pretty good conviction that's not based on some fairy tale somewhere that you are going to be playing some Angry Bird on your iPad tonight, right? This is more what the Bible talks about when it uses the word faith. Not wishing, not this blind faith, but something that is based on evidence. The kind of thing the Bible talks about when we see the word faith is evidence leading to knowledge that gives you an assurance of things you can't see. Even though you're not physically looking at that iPad, you have a pretty good idea. You have justified beliefs that you are going to be playing some Angry Bird tonight. So blind faith is just like blowing out your birthday candles, making a wish. But biblical faith is more like tracking a package. It's the kind of knowledge that's based on evidence, an assurance of something that you can't see. What I want us to notice about this idea is that illustrations can clarify an idea by relating it to something that your friend already knows about. For example, you remember that old movie, Speed, with Keanu Reeves. They called it Die Hard on a Bus. Oh, people are like, okay, I get that. Or the classic movie Alien. They said, it's Jaws, but on a spaceship. And so people go, okay, fine, I get that. And when you give an example like that, especially one that includes some kind of human action, like tracking a package, these are the things that tend to stick. It actually makes these illustrations easier to remember. But what kind of evidence do we have that God is even real? And why would it even matter if God was real? I hear that from a lot of students around California, and a lot of these students are into a little social networking website called Facebook. And believe it or not, you can get an apologetics illustration out of Facebook. Which, by the way, if you are on Facebook, if you look up apologetics guy, I have a page there. I was on my computer, and every day I have three or four friends who have birthdays, and so this guy comes up who I knew from high school, and it said that it was his birthday. Not a very uncommon thing. I see that a lot. But this one was different. This one was different because it really wasn't his birthday. It wasn't his birthday because the guy had been dead for over a year. A dead guy's Facebook page is an eerie thing. I can't say I really knew him that well. He looked the same in his profile picture. His status had not been updated for a year. You want to know what his last status update was? Just saying, best night ever. I have no idea what that was about. But this kind of thing can make people think, is this all there is to life? What's going to be left after we die? An abandoned Facebook page with all your popular friends on it? A pile of money in the bank? Other symbols of success that we spend our every waking moment trying to attain? Is this really all there is, really? And here's the point. If God's not real, then you, me, every single one of your friends and family members, in fact, the world we live in, is a big accident. We're what happens when you take time, chance, and stuff and throw it in the mix. There's no real purpose to life. There's no real reason we're even here. There's no real reason we're even alive. And so who cares if you had 1,000 Facebook friends? Who cares if you were the most popular kid at school? Who cares if you landed that great job, had an awesome career, had the coolest car, the nicest house? And this can really get you depressed, because life without God is like a dead guy's Facebook page. This is something I've found that people connect with. I mean, the fact that it's not really my friend's birthday, kind of unexpected. Looking at Facebook on your computer is an action that you can imagine, and it does touch us emotionally to think about a friend that might die. See, if God isn't real, we are just sitting around waiting to die. But here's the difference that God makes. If God is real, your life has real meaning. You are not an accident. If God exists, this life is not all there is. Furthermore, if Christianity is true, eternal life is possible and available to you. So are there any good reasons for us to believe that God's real? Ever been to those relative parties where you feel like you're sitting around waiting to die? You know, people are watching CNN. They're reading magazines. It's like you're at an airport waiting for the flight that's never gonna show up, right? Sorry. Maybe some of you know what I'm talking about, though. Well, imagine you're at a party like that and somebody takes out a deck of cards and they begin to shuffle it and they're like, just a regular set of cards right here. You're like, oh, what are you talking about? You're gonna do a magic trick for us? What are you doing? So just a regular set of cards. And you know what's coming. They're going to be like, let's cut the deck, okay? Just for the sake of illustration here, will somebody in the front row, just y'all stop. Just somebody just y'all stop sometime. Stop. All right, thank you. So you know what's coming next, right? They're going to say, okay, go ahead and take that card. Now, for the sake of illustration, I'm not going to have anybody come up here, but I'm just going to pull the card out for illustration. And they're going to say, all right, now I want you to memorize this card. I want you to look at it. And I want you to burn that into your memory. And then I want you to show it around, right? Show it off to people. And I'm actually quite interested in what this card is right now. But I'm going to stay in character here, okay? So the memorize that thing, pass it around, right? And then normally they'll say, go ahead and put it back in the deck. And then they're going to like look through it. For the sake of illustration, I'm just going to put it on the very top, all right? So, same card on the very top. So now they're going to do some mental magic, right? This is the relative party that's going nowhere. So they're going to really ham this up. It's the only card trick they know. So, all right, now I want you to think about the card. Seriously, think about it. Oh, I'm going to start. Oh, I see. They're really hamming this up, right? I see black clouds. It's dark. Something of infinity. Is that an infinity symbol? No, it's... Is it the Eight of Clubs? What was the card?
Yeah.
Was it?
Six.
Oh, wow, that actually worked. Yeah. Go figure. Yeah. Now, what on earth are the chances that that was just totally random? No, I rigged it because it's a card trick, right? Yeah. That's the point. Kind of like if you went to, say you missed the church here, if you're not from Ridgeway and you're trying to find this place. Say you missed the church and you ended up at the casino. You're walking around going, man, this Bridgeway, this is a big place, man. If you saw a guy who was just sitting at the poker table winning all day long, the guy can't be beat, security is not going to think that your winning streak is just because you're awesome at poker. No, they're going to think you're cheating. You're going to think you rigged this. They're going to think you rigged this. Just like this, we find some awesome examples of things in the universe that really seem like they were not the result of random chance. These things seem like they were really designed. Somebody rigged this. This wasn't just random. And you don't have to go far out into the far reaches of the galaxy to find this stuff. Here's one that might be closer than you think. Instructional information in our DNA. Let me show you what that looks like right here on the screen. These letters, A, T, G, and C, are the nucleotide bases. Adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. Now, even if you're not a science type, what you need to know is that the order of these letters communicates a very, very specific set of instructions for building proteins within the cell. And so this is kind of like the way that letters appear in a book to make up words or sentences. This is like HTML or ActionScript or any other kind of computer program. You know, Richard Dawkins, the British evolutionary biologist, took a look at this and he said, the machine code looks uncannily computer-like. You know, Bill Gates from Microsoft says that DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. So when you take a look at this, you see that the letters A, T, G, and C work just like a secret code or letters in a book. And so the big question is, where did this information come from? If you have information, where did it come from? The origin of life biologist Bernd Olaf Cooper says that the question of the origin of life is clearly basically equivalent to the question of the origin of biological information. If God didn't write that, where'd that come from? You have information, somebody wrote it. Undirected chance can't fully explain things like this, things that really seem like they were designed. And so what can we learn from this and how can we illustrate this? Imagine you bought a new camera and you unpack the box and you found this instruction manual in there. Honestly, who even reads these, right? But let's say you, if I can't use your camera without reading a thing like this, I'm not gonna buy it. But let's say you actually looked at this and it would be dumb if your kid asked, Dad, where'd this come from? Who wrote this? And you said, nobody. Nobody wrote this. No, somebody wrote this. You have a set of instructions that implies an author. Somebody wrote this. Furthermore, you know, somebody once said, was flipping through this at one of these relative parties, they're like, the problem is there's just more than one language nowadays. So you see this, if it's in Japanese and in French and in Spanish, you know that somebody translated that for you. Furthermore, if you were a secret spy and you found a secret agent spy and you found a hidden code in here, you'd know that somebody planted that there for you, right? So when you have information that's encoded, you know that you have an encoder. Third, information processing systems imply programmers. When you have information for building proteins within the cell, and you see that being carried out, we've got an information processing system. This is kind of like your computer's operating system or your computer's processor. Windows 7 didn't just pop out of nowhere uncaused, out of nothing. Somebody programmed that. And so we see from this example that instructional information implies an author, encoded information implies an encoder, and an information processing system implies a programmer. So the design we see in nature tells us about the existence of an intelligent designer. The information in your DNA is like an instruction manual. With this example, you've got the opportunity to get concrete objects involved. That helps things to stick. It's great for when you're teaching your kids. It's good for sharing this material with small groups. A deck of cards, an instruction manual. If you are out with one of your skeptical friends, maybe the lunch menu at the restaurant. Take a look at that. It would be dumb to say nobody wrote that. We have information there. That implies an author. So even if you were just to have somebody imagine a concrete object, like an instruction manual, it actually makes these illustrations easier to remember. But probably the number one reason why people say they have a hard time believing in God is the problem of evil and suffering in the world. Where was God on 9/11? Why did he even allow the possibility of evil and suffering? Last night, Clay Jones showed us how the Christian worldview makes sense of this problem. And we know that because God is a God of love, he wanted to create human beings who could freely choose to love him for real, because real love can't be forced, right? And so God gave us freedom so that we could love. But by giving us freedom so we could love, he also made it possible for us to be free to do evil. But God wanted to create free people who could freely choose to love him for real. What would it look like if God just didn't give us freedom? What would that look like? Couldn't God have made a world where people weren't free? Could God make a world of creatures that were not free? I'm going to show you a little toy that my son was given when he was a baby. We call this Praying Lion. It's not really called Praying Lion. It's called Daily Blessings. But the reason we call it Praying Lion is because when you squeeze him, he says this.
Thank you for all my toys and fun, and for every day you shine the sun.
Isn't that cute? Now, God could have populated the world with 2.5 billion of these little guys. It would be a very cute world. But we wouldn't have any human beings there. These guys could be programmed all day long to be like, thank you, God.
For each new morning and its light, for rest and shelter of the night.
Yeah, and on they would go. We love you, God. You are awesome. There's no one like you. Gee, thanks. That was really nice. But I think we can see how this would be a very fulfilling relationship for God. You know, I have a real little boy, Jojo. I don't have Astro Boy. I didn't make me a little robot kid, right? I'm married to a real woman, thank the Lord. I don't have a robot wife. Christine can really love me. As Clay Jones said, nobody really wants a robot wife, like in that movie, The Stepford Wives. Remember how Clay Jones said that a robot wife is only two steps above inflatable? That is the kind of thing that sticks. That's three steps, thank you. You guys remember that. There's a big distinction there. Putting ourselves in someone else's shoes can often give us a new perspective on important issues like this. So you could just describe this kind of thing to your friend and say, why wouldn't you want to be married to a robot? Why don't you want a robot kid? Now, why do you think God would want something like that? So you could say that God made evil possible by giving us free will so we could love, but he also made evil actual, or we made evil actual by choosing to do evil. Okay? So we could say God made evil possible by giving us free will so we could love, but we made evil actual by choosing to do evil. For God, having people without freedom is like having a robot wife or a robot kid. Not a great recipe for a fulfilling relationship. So maybe it's pretty easy to see that God doesn't want to be married to or have a relationship with a bunch of automatons. But why would God allow stuff that happened like in Alabama in the southern states or the disaster in Japan? What possible good could come out of some of these things that look like pointless suffering. Something we need to understand is that we're not God's pets. God's job is not to keep this nice little habitat, this little aquarium for us and keep it clean, make sure we're not swimming in our own filth. That's not God's job. And according to the Christian worldview, the purpose of life is not our comfort, but it's knowing God more. And so things that might look like pointless suffering might be pointless in terms of making us more comfortable, but it might not be pointless in terms of bringing us to a deeper, a fuller knowledge of God, of who he is. And this is what ultimately is going to lead to lasting human fulfillment. But when you're going through things that just seem pointless to you, you think, how can God have a good reason for this? I just don't see it. There's no way I can think of that this would even, that anything good could come out of this. I learned a lot about this when I became a dad. Many years ago, my wife and I went to the Philippines to be missionaries, and before we left for the field, I had to take my son, Jojo, who wasn't even a year old, I had to take him to get a number of required shots, not only for being a baby, but for living overseas. So if your parents imagine this, you can get him dressed up in a little onesie, you put his little socks on, yay, we're going out! I take him to the doctor. And they shoot him up with two injections in both legs, simultaneously. Now, I was actually helping them. I was helping the nurses hold down the little legs of my baby boy. And my baby boy was looking at me with these eyes going, why are you helping the bad people? They're hurting me. What possible good could come out of this? Man, sometimes I feel like that in my life. But I know that just because I don't know what those good reasons are, doesn't mean that they're not there. God can have good reasons for allowing us to go through things, even if we don't know what those reasons are. Just because we don't know the reason why he allows this or that instance of evil or suffering, it doesn't mean that a good reason doesn't exist. It doesn't mean that he doesn't have a good reason for allowing it. And so us not knowing why bad things happen is kind of like a baby getting his shots. What I want us to know about the story here is that we connect a lot more with a story when we feel something. Especially when we feel something for one specific person. I've done this a lot, and this happens every time, because I think about my little boy and that little face. Why are you helping the bad people? Again, these are the things that tend to stick. Recently, I met a number of college students who say, you know, I believe in God, but I'm really more spiritual than religious. Anybody hear that? I'm more spiritual than religious? Okay. In the USA, according to USA Today, 72% of Americans will actually talk, 72% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 will talk about themselves like this. And I've found this with a number of non-Christian students that I've worked with. They'll say they're spiritual, but not religious. Some will even say they believe in heaven. But they might also ask, why do I need Jesus? Why do I need Jesus to go to heaven? I'm not a bad person. What's Christianity's take on that? Why does Christianity say, I need Jesus? Now, if you ask these people, you know, how do you think people get to heaven? A lot of people will say, well, I try to live a good life. I try to do more good things than bad things. And if I'm generally a good person, I think generally good people will go to heaven. Now, ironically, this is a very, very religious view. Actually, it is the belief of the second largest religion in the world, Islam. Because according to the Quran, Allah is going to weigh your deeds on a cosmic scale of infinite justice. If your good deeds weigh more than your bad, you're in. If your bad deeds weigh more than your good, well, the Quran says, in hell you will abide. Seems to make sense, right? But this isn't the Christian view. This isn't the Christian view at all. So how could this make sense? Why can't we just do more good than evil? Why do we really need Jesus to get to heaven? This last illustration I want to share with you is one of the most helpful that I heard during my time in my master's program at Biola, and it leads us right into the heart of the gospel. I want you to imagine that you're driving down Sunset out here, driving down Sunset Boulevard on the way to this conference. You're running a little late. You're just about to go through an intersection up here when the light turns red. It's early. You're trying to make the 8 a.m. breakout. There's really nobody here, so you run this thing like it's not even there. And then you see some lights behind you. Oh, didn't see that cop hiding behind the bush. So you get a ticket. You show up in Placer Superior Court. The judge asks you if you ran the red light. Say, yes, yes, judge, yes, I did. And I did it intentionally too, because I was going to be late to this big important church conference. Okay. And the judge says, well, okay, then just pay the fine. Now, what if you say, Judge, no, you don't understand. I shouldn't have to pay the fine. And the judge will say, why? Well, you don't get it, Judge. See, I'm not a criminal, really. Basically a good person. Yes, I ran one red light, but before I ran that red light, listen carefully, I stopped at 5 other red lights, and I went through 5 green ones. So that's got to count for something, right? Now, of course, the point of this story is that you don't earn brownie points for just obeying the law. Trying to get out of a red light violation by just going through green lights doesn't make any sense. So we see that, you know, this is just like if you were on trial for murdering somebody and you say, Judge, yeah, I killed one guy, but I let 300 other people in the building live. It's crazy. And yet, we chuckle at that, but this is what so many people are going to try to offer up at the great white throne judgment. They're going to say, yes, God, I've cheated, I've stolen, I've looked at people with lust in my heart, but you know what? I was faithful to my wife my whole life. I helped the neighbor move. Went to church every week. A guru told me to do some chanting. How about that? How does any of this cover over our sin? The big problem is none of this has anything to do with our crimes against God. And so this is what one thing that makes Christianity unique among world religions. Other religions, the cults of Christianity, are going to say, here's a better way to make yourself more righteous. Here's a better way to keep following the law. But it has nothing to do with covering over our sin. This doesn't make up for our sin at all. You know that when you break the law, you owe a debt. And that debt's got to be paid in order for justice to be served. Anselm of Canterbury says that when you sin against an infinite God, you incur an infinite debt. Imagine you got fined $436 for that red light violation. You could probably pay that. It wouldn't be very fun, but you could probably pay that. Imagine you killed somebody, and as things worked out, you got 30 years in prison. Okay, most of us in this room could probably pay that. But what if your sentence was infinity years in prison? You could never pay that thing off. And so we could spend our entire existence separated from God. We could add to our existence one moment after another, separated from God, and we would never come close to paying that thing off. Never. Who can pay an infinite debt? Only the one who is infinite. But God didn't sin, we sinned, right? And so that is why we have Jesus, who took on a human nature so he could become the new representative of mankind, live a sinless life, and pay that infinite debt in a finite period of time. The resurrection of Jesus in time and space is objective proof that the debt has been paid. Justice has been served. The debt has been satisfied. All other religions are going to say, here's a better way to make yourself more righteous. Christianity says, put your trust in God because Jesus already did the work. Just like the Apostle Paul says, for it is by grace that you have been saved through faith, and this is not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. So trying to make up for your sins by doing more good things is just like trying to get out of that red light violation by going through green lights. I first heard this illustration about 10 years ago, and I can still remember it pretty well. Why? Because it has concrete objects, physical actions that you can imagine, a car running a red light. There's a surprising twist there, that crazy appeal to the judge. Judge, I don't have to pay the fine. I'm basically a good person. For a lot of people, this is the kind of illustration that's simple to get and easy to remember. So here's what you need to know today. I think there are 3 essential elements to everyday apologetics: getting answers for yourself, giving answers to others, and being wise ambassadors of Jesus. Part of that's listening, asking good questions, but part of that is also making our answers memorable. Now, in just a few moments, you're going to get to hear a presentation by J.P. Moreland on Christianity and the nature of science. As you listen to his presentation, as you continue your studies through some of the materials that we have available today, some of the materials that we have online, pay attention to the examples. Write them down, maybe even keep a little notebook of these examples and commit some of them to memory so that they'll be available when you have them. Oh, one more thing. If you liked any of the examples that you heard me share this morning, please download a sample lesson from the Accessible Apologetics curriculum so that you can see how to actually use these in your small groups, in your churches, even teaching your own kids. And you can get that on my blog at apologeticsguy.com. So let's be on the lookout for these examples, and let's share good reasons to believe in a way that's simple to get and easy to remember. Thank you.